John Smith, okay, that's the English spelling of his name. We would spell it S-M-I-T-H. William Brewster, John Robinson, or William Bradford? We're going to talk...
It seemed like I've heard William Bradford. I couldn't tell you who he did, but
okay.
It sort of sounds like...
We're going to talk about some of these men this morning. We'll get into them a little bit more in depth. I wanted to put their names up because as we start talking about them a little bit, hopefully it'll help keep each of them straight in your mind. So we've been talking a lot about the history of the church as of recent. And we've come to the Church of England or the Catholic Church in England, separating from Rome and the official Catholic Church. And what was it that caused that major division? That the church, the Catholic individuals in England wanted to separate. What was it that caused that initially?
Henry VIII,
exactly. Henry VIII, and it was over an issue of what in general? One thing.
Divorce
and his wife and marriage. Catherine of Aragon and several others. He had to, at a young age of 8, whenever he became the King of England, he was arranged as a marriage with his deceased brother's wife, and he didn't love her, and he wanted to marry another woman, his lady-in-waiting. And so there were major issues, and he sought for an annulment from the church in Rome, and they wouldn't give it to him, so he got the annulment locally. And that was really the division, and it created the Church of England. But unfortunately, the Church of England looked almost identical with the Catholic Church back in Europe. What was the only main difference?
Who was the head?
Who was the head? In Rome it was?
The Pope.
In England it was? The king. The sovereign king was ruler over the state, and he was ruler over the church as well. Any potential problems with that? Absolutely. Absolutely, we have an abuse of authority and power, much like we saw in the 300s when Constantine became the emperor. And he declared Christianity the religion of the empire. There were abuses of power that came along with that. So Henry VIII caused that division. When Henry died, his daughter Mary was very much against the Christian faith, and she tried to turn things back to Catholicism. And after she was finished, there was Queen Elizabeth. And she was a good queen, for the most part, for England. And she wanted to bring Protestantism back in the area. She did so much to allow freedom of religion that she worked with Parliament to have the Act of Conformity, also called the Act of Uniformity, signed. There wanted to be one major religion in England, and that was her goal. And it made it illegal to skip services. You had to pay a fine if you didn't attend service on Sundays, and an additional fines for more egregious offenses. It was 1 shilling if you missed Sunday services. The English Parliament also worked with her to create the Westminster Assembly to prepare a statement of principles by which the church could be ruled, and this would be called the Confessions of Faith. Confessions of Faith. In addition to that, there was a man named, I won't write his name up, Thomas Cranmer. Thomas Cranmer. Anybody heard of that name? Okay, so he worked to write a book called the Confessions, based on the Confessions of Faith, the Common Prayer Book in England. And it included the daily devotionals that they were supposed to have. It included the Apocrypha, which many of the Catholic churches had at the time. And this really replaced the Bible in England. It replaced the Bible in England. And the people started using this common book of prayer, more so than the scriptures themselves. Very dangerous. Very dangerous. This book, you'll notice that this is a color version. This is the 1559 version of his book. And you'll notice that some of it is in red ink. And it was actually in red ink that they used. And because of that red ink, they often called it the Rubrics book in England that they followed. It was revised a few times, but this took the place of Wycliffe's version that we read about in the early 1400s, and then later the Tyndale Bible is the one that had been smuggled into England. This took their place and became the most common Bible, if you can even call it that, at the time. There were men that were doing things that they shouldn't have been doing in this early church in England. They were using the sign of the cross during baptism for infants, which is nowhere found in the scriptures. They began using, also written in this book, deciding that a ring should be used in marriage. They hadn't really been using one before. It started here in this book that they should have a sign and use a ring for marriage. They began in this book talking that the people should kneel at the Lord's table before they partook of communion. And there was also the vestments that needed to be worn, the surplice, by the priests at the time, to help distinguish them and give them honor and preference so that everybody would know who they were. Now, it wasn't uncommon for preachers and teachers at this time to wear robes, particularly if they were a teacher in one of the colleges. There was the Corpus Christi College. There was Oxford and Cambridge over there that had a lot of theological and divinity studies. And these men who were doctorates or magistrates in these colleges often wore the gown. When you go to a graduation ceremony, and I'm sure many of you have within the last month, what did the doctors wear? They wore the robes, the funny hat, the big, huge, poofy sleeves and everything else. That came out of a lot of the English traditions. But they began wearing those in the worship service. In the worship service. Does that remind you of anything from the New Testament?
Pharisees.
Okay, what does it say about them?
Well, they liked to impress people with how they looked. They would have written scriptures, and they would roll it up and stick it in their sleeves and all types of different various things. And their appearance was really made to impress people, but Jesus said you're just a bunch of whitewashed tombs.
Okay.
Inside is just dead people's bones.
It all became about show and pageantry. And the look and the outward appearance rather than what was on the inside. And there was a lot of people in England that were disgusted by this obnoxious ecclesiastical attitude that was starting to develop. And they said, it's looking just like the Catholic Church that we saw back in Europe. We've got to make a change. And initially, those people were called the what? Puritans. Because they wanted to purify the Church of England. They didn't start off with the intent to create a new faith or a new religion. They sought to purify the Church of England, and so they were called such. Eventually, with time, though, a group of the Puritans wanted to go even further and said, you know, the Church of England is beyond repair. Instead of purifying it, we're going to have to start a new one. They were called the Separatists, often called the Congregationalists, and whenever they got in a boat and came to America, this man here, William Bradford, who was an author at the time, a young man, started writing and referencing back to Hebrews chapter 11 that says what? They were strangers and pilgrims because they sought a new land, a homeland. They wanted to get away from the religious tyranny of the day, even in England. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in the time we have remaining, but that's where the term pilgrim actually came from. It was those Puritans that left and became Congregationalists and came over to America. There was a couple other men that we'll just briefly touch on during the Reformation in England. One was Robert Brown, who after 5 years, when Queen Elizabeth allowed a lot of this religious freedom and the exiles to come back, there were more than 20,000 of these separatists living in the London area. A pretty big movement that got the attention of the government. That was led by Robert Brown. And here is what Robert Brown wrote to Queen Elizabeth at the time. Let me, in a word or two, give you warning of the other sorts of enemies of Christ's kingdom, the Pharisees of these times. I mean your great learned preachers, your good men that sigh and groan for reformation, but their bands with their sluggard deny to work. These counterfeits would raise up a second error, even as the second beast, by so much more dangerous. By now hath it more show the truth. These men, instead of this gross anti-Christian government, which is now manifest and odious unto all men, would bring in a new, adulterate, forged government in show, or rather in despite, of Christ's government. They, in their pride, rashness, ignorance, and sensuality of their fleshly hearts, most miserably innovate and corrupt Christ's government over his churches. Not a bad statement from Robert Brown. And that's why a lot of people began to follow him, and they called them Brownites. And there were over 20,000 of them within 5 years of starting up. Another was John Smith, who I have written on the board. He was a prominent preacher, and like many of these other men, like Luther and Calvin, they all started within the Catholic Church and the Church of England for John Smith. And he was a minister, and he got fed up with the act of conformity and this prayer book that I have up ahead. And he decided to leave England and go across the channel back to Europe. And it wasn't but about 2 days' journey, if the weather was good, into Holland. And there he started a church in Amsterdam. He learned to reject infant baptism, and he picked up on the influence of the Mennonites, or the Dunkers, the German Dunkers who came up from Switzerland and Germany, who branched off of Martin Luther. And so he began to put away the infant baptism of his youth, and decided to baptize himself, John Smith. So there's a term that comes with that. And many people believe that he is the first Baptist. And he performed a baptism for himself, and that's why he is called a sea Baptist. But in fact, he didn't immerse himself. He sprinkled himself, which was inaccurate. It wasn't until a couple hundred years later that the Baptists began to go back to the practice of immersion.
Didn't he believe in immersion, though?
He did, but it was much later on in his life. And he picked up that influence from several others that came down to Amsterdam. So he initially was one of the first that left England and came to Amsterdam and started a congregation of there, picked up the influence of the Mennonites and several of the other reformers in Europe. And they had a pretty big congregation there. This Bradford, who had already documented once, was speaking about John Smith whenever he said that he's a man of inconsistencies and unstable judgment. Many considered him, like I said, one of the first pioneers of the Baptist faith, if not later followed by Roger Williams, who picked it up and was a student of John Smith who came to the United States and started one of the first Baptist congregations in Salem, Massachusetts. Let's all turn to 2 Corinthians. We'll read a passage here. Chapter 6. We've got a lot of people fed up with the Church of England, and they want to do something about it. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Would somebody read verses 14 through the end of the chapter? 14 through 18.
Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are all the temple of the living God, as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty.
Okay, I bring this up because this man who I've read a lot of his stuff and got a lot of my notes from today, William Bradford, who was writing as a contemporary at the time, this was the passage he used to kind of define what was going on in England at the time with the Puritans, specifically quoting verse 14, "Come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord." That was the passage that he quoted at that time. And there were a lot of men that did that. I'll write one more name here at the top, or over at this board. Richard Clifton. He was one of these Puritan men in England. He was a minister in the Church of England, but didn't agree with the Act of Conformity. And so he began a large separatist movement at this location here, the All Saints Church in Babworth, England. And he held a pretty prominent place for quite some time. And as his congregation began to grow, the Church of England took notice and basically excommunicated him from the church. And he was left without a place to worship with all of his followers. Many of the things that he taught was good, and it was headed in the right direction, although he was errant in some matters of faith. So after he lost his congregation, he met up with a man named William Brewster, who was living in this little town called Scrooby. He was the bailiff, and he was also the postmaster, and he worked out of the manor house in Scrooby. His dad was an official, and when his dad passed away, he was appointed to replace him at the congregation here. So Clifton, after he lost his congregation at Babworth, came and started worshiping at Scrooby with William Brewster. And they had a good congregation. A lot of the things that they did were in accordance with the things that we're doing. They rejected the ecclesiastical system. They wanted to have a local congregation ruled by the elders of that congregation. Their leadership format was a little bit different, actually quite a bit different than what we have today. They had ruling elders and teaching elders. We won't get into all those concepts, but they had some teaching elders and some ruling elders that together formed what they considered the eldership. They also had deacons in many of these churches that attended the physical matters of the congregation. After a few years of meeting at this congregation, there was about 200 to 300 members at the time. They decided that they needed to start worshiping and some other houses because they were becoming too popular and taking too much note. I want to read just a little bit here again from Bradford. He says, in 1607, the people who were thus insistent, the positive and practical part of divine institutions became two distinct bodies or churches for the sake of convenience in holding their assemblies, inasmuch as their homes were dispersed over the territory too wide for the meeting in one place, especially in those times. After the vision, one of the two churches met ordinarily in the manor house at Scrooby. As at Colossae, there was a church in the house of Philemon, and in Laodicea, a house in the church of Nymphas, and in Corinth, there was a church in the house of Aquila and Priscilla, and afterward another in their house at Rome. So this church, instituted without asking Caesar's permission, so was this one here in Scrooby. It may have been called the church that was in the house of William Brewster. This was the germ of New England. Interesting comments about people meeting in homes again because of persecution from the church and the government, which were united at the time. Another quote from Bradford in talking about this time, Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 through 6. Does anybody have that one committed to memory? Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths. They wanted a new path to take for their freedom. And so they too decided, like John Smith, to go to Holland to seek religious freedom. And they did so. So first of all, they worked with one of the local shipyards to procure a ship where that entire congregation could load up and sail a couple days across over into Holland. Unfortunately, the shipmaster, the captain, betrayed them. And as they were sailing out of port in the cover of darkness in the middle of the night, he warned the port authorities, and the soldiers came after him in another ship. And for some reason, their ship wasn't able to outrun the other one that was coming after them from the harbor, because the captain put the anchor down and let it drag the ground so they could be caught. The captain had been bribed by the English guards and authorities to detain them. So they came back and they had to stay another 6 months. And many of them were imprisoned during that time. and persecuted for trying to flee from England. So they tried again in 6 months. This time, they worked with an independent Dutch company to sail them across. And this one worked out a little bit better. The men got on board the day before because they were loading everything up and they didn't want the men and the women to travel together. The next day, the women came to get on the ship. And once again, the English soldiers came with their muskets loaded and on horseback and cut them off. All the men were on the ship and they began firing at them, and all the women were in little rowboats trying to make it out there. The ship took off and left without the women. And so it was a very sad time for these men. They went on to Amsterdam because the captain of the ship said, "We're not turning back," and getting sunk by the English soldiers. They felt bad, the English did, about keeping the men, about keeping the women and children. And so after a few months, they did let them go to Amsterdam to rejoin their husbands and their fathers. Any questions? There's a lot of history there. We've got about 15 more minutes. Okay, so the women join up with the men in Amsterdam. You'll remember that John Smith went over to Amsterdam first and started a congregation and developed some of his own teachings. And now Brewster, Robinson, Bradford, and I'll leave Clifton on there because he came over a little bit earlier. They all came together and met up with them. Instead of starting their own congregation, they joined with the congregation of John Smith. So imagine today if there were two congregations who were having persecution from the government or from the community or whatever the case may be, and they both had to move to a third independent location. Do you think that there may be some challenges in the leadership of one congregation working with the leadership of another congregation that had different opinions and different thoughts? Yeah, obviously so. And there were differences between these congregations. There were a lot of problems, in fact, in this early church in Amsterdam. There was a preacher by the name of Francis Johnson who was already staying in Amsterdam before Smith and the others even came over. And part of the problem with him being the pastor is that he married a woman whose husband had passed away. And he was a wealthy man, a merchant, a seaman. And so she had this historical influence of having a lot of wealth and luxurious living. And then she married this Francis Johnson, who was a humble preacher in the church. And it was hard for her to step away from some of her old habits. And so she had a bodice, which was kind of like the outward corset that had all the lacing and everything up the front. She had it decorated with whalebone. And also on the collar of her blouse, she had whalebones embroidered on it. And she wore corks in her shoes. Can you believe it? She had corks in her shoes to give her a little bit of a lift. And all the members of the congregation thought that was despicable, that she would adorn herself so outwardly and make such a show of her attire and her apparel. That was one of the issues of contention in the church, how this lady had dressed herself. There were other issues as well, but all kinds of problems. I'm going to read you a little bit about what was going on in the congregation there at that time in Amsterdam. It says, "At Amsterdam, before their division and breach, there were about 300 communicants, and they had for their pastor and teacher the two eminent men before them named, and in our time, four grave men of ruling elders, and three able and godly men for deacons. One ancient widow for a deaconess, who did serve them many years, though she was 60 years of age when she was chosen. She honored her place and was an ornament to the congregation. She usually sat in a convenient place in the congregation with a little birchen rod in her hand and kept the little children in great awe from disturbing the congregation. She did frequently visit the sick and weak, and especially women, and as there was need, called out maids and young women to watch out for them as helps and necessity did require. And as if were poor, she would gather relief for those who were able or acquainted by the deacons. And she was obeyed as a mother in Israel and officer of Christ." Interesting. A deaconess. Any thoughts or comments about this position in that early church at Amsterdam? This was the first I'd really come across a deaconess position in the early church. Anybody else do any reading or comments or thoughts about that?
Paul commending and reference that as the authority for having women deacons, because she's commended as a steward of God, and I think the word there can also be rendered deaconess. But you know, when we look at the qualifications for deacons, it really, we have to know that those two passages can't conflict with each other. So it must mean that she was just a servant of the Lord, and that there really wasn't a position for women as deacons.
That's how I interpret it as well, is that this was not an official leadership position in the church, but it was a term that was used that we don't use commonly today that has caused some misconception of this deaconess or this helpful lady. So, multiple problems in that congregation over there with multiple issues. These men here decided that they were going to leave Amsterdam and travel 40 miles to the south to a place called Leiden. Holland, often spelled L-E-I-D-E-N. They left this man behind, Richard Clifton, because he was getting older in age, and he began to slip back to some of the Puritan days and have more of that ecclesiastical form. So those three men there with several others left, and they started a new congregation all of their own instead of trying to join with one that was already there. John Robinson took Clifton's place and transitioned from teacher to pastor, and the office of teacher was not filled intentionally. William Brewster was a ruling elder, and he bought a printing press in Leiden and began printing lots of tracts and materials and shipping them back to England. William Bradford was a member there and an author that I've been quoting. John Carver was a deacon, and Samuel Fuller was also a deacon as well as a physician. It wasn't long before this congregation back in Amsterdam called upon the church at Leiden to help take care of some issues. They couldn't get rid of some of their problems that they have. And they called upon the assistance of this newfound congregation. And they were reluctant to go over and help the congregation at first because they thought it would be a conflict of interest. But eventually Robinson and Brewster did go back to Amsterdam to try to help that old congregation work on some of the problems that they had over there.
What's the years, approximate years of all this?
1615 is the approximate year that this is starting. So, that's a common situation that we have in the world today and in Christianity today, is that there are problems in congregations. And much like the early part of the Catholic Church, there were problems, and they tried to resolve them. So they brought men in from different places who would have the rule and the decision over them. It gets away from the autonomy of a congregation. One congregation shouldn't be telling another congregation what to do. We need to have the appropriate offices as listed in the New Testament Scriptures from the apostolic age of an evangelist who traveled around and worked with many congregations and was sent out by a local congregation. But that didn't exist at this time. So they went over and tried to help, but they couldn't really help. Now, the last thing that we're going to talk about in the 5-10 minutes remaining is what this small congregation in Leiden wanted to do. The 30 Years' War with Spain was going on with Holland and some of the kings in Spain. And they decided that they wanted to seek their own religious freedom. And they wanted to go somewhere completely new. Where do you think they wanted to go? They wanted to come to America to practice religious freedom. Now, there have been people from England coming to America for many years before that. Sir Walter Raleigh came over about 30 years prior. And there were other English churches that kind of came with that and began to settle in the Virginia area. But this congregation wanted to make their own journey. So they sent John Robinson, who had some training in law, back to England. And he negotiated with the dignitaries of the day. He didn't speak with the king directly, but he spoke with his representatives. And he spoke with the London, Virginia Trading Company to procure a ship and land and a charter to be able to take that ship over and to start a new colony based on religious freedom in America. It was a long process. It took several years for them to eventually acquire that. But once they did, they all loaded up on a ship down in Leiden. It was called the Speedwell, and took it across over to London to join up with a larger ship called the Mayflower. They loaded up the Speedwell with all of their supplies and a few of the staff and everything else, and they basically had some test runs with it and found out that it leaked. It was unseaworthy. They had to bring it back into harbor, load everything up onto the Mayflower. There were 201 passengers. About 70 of them were members from this original congregation at Leiden, Holland. They chose some of the strongest men and women to go because they knew that it was going to be a long voyage at sea and it was going to be at winter time whenever they arrived in the Americas. So they wanted to go ahead and establish the colony over there and get things going in the church before the others came over. They took off in the Mayflower, about 70 of them. The rest of them were businessmen from London, tradesmen, soldiers, smiths, and things like that to help grow the colony. Once they got in, about a month into the journey, there was a terrible storm, and because the Mayflower was so overladen with goods and surplus and people, the mast broke in half. But one of the congregation members from back in Leiden had brought along a huge iron screw, and they put that in the mast and were able to repair the mast and continue the journey across. It was supposed to take about a month and a half to 2 months to sail across. It took them over 3 months. They left on September 9th, and they arrived in late November. It was freezing cold. They came around, I don't know if I've got a map. There's the town of Leiden, where they worshipped in Holland. You can see in the red, the little tip there, that's Cape Cod. They landed at Providencetown. They initially, their charter was, they were supposed to go to Virginia, south of there, but because of the bad weather, they wound up heading up north, and that's where they landed. They stayed in the harbor for several days before they debarked because of the weather being so bad, and it was on the Mayflower that they had their Mayflower Compact. And I've got just one little quote, because I wanted to impress some of their opinions about their faith in it. Okay, from the Mayflower Compact. For the general good of the colony under which we promise all due submission and obedience. In the name of God, amen. We whose names are underwritten, the loyal subjects of our dread sovereign, Lord King James, and dread sovereign just means honorable, not fearful, by the grace of God of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, King, defender of the faith, having undertaken for the glory of God the advancements of the Christian faith and honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, although they wound up coming up north, do by these presents solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid, and by virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame, and just equal laws, ordinance, acts, constitutions, and office from time to time, and shall be, though most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, into which we promise all due submission and obedience. Amen. And they signed it. And a lot of the signers of the Mayflower Compact were members of the congregation from Leiden, Holland. They landed at the end of November, and as you know, the rest is history. They had a very tough time. Over half of the ship died. Several of them died at sea. There was a berth at sea. Oceanus was his name. But that first year, over half of them died. And when it was all said and done after the winter, there was only about four families that remained from that initial congregation. They met up with the Indians. They learned how to plant. They stole some of their corn to start with. They had some skirmishes with the Indians there when they landed as well. But initially, they formed their own congregation over there. And it prospered for a little while. It became known as the Episcopal Church later on, though, after they merged with the Church of England. The Church of England sent people over as well, and things started to fall apart soon after that. So although they sought religious freedom, it began to fade away with all the troubles and persecution that arose at the time. Other men came over, like Roger Williams, who started the Baptist Church in Salem. John Glass and Robert Sandeman came over as well. John Wesley, about 100 years later in 1735, who started the Methodist faith, came over as well and started the Methodist congregations in the United States. So although there was a mass exile for the right reasons, it started to fall apart shortly thereafter once they got settled over here. Next week, we're not going to talk about all the denominations that started up in America, but we're going to start with the Restoration Movement with Campbell and Stone, and what really generated that Restoration Movement in America. We got just a couple minutes for comments here, if anybody would like to make any. There were.
Several came over the next few years and brought more of that congregation over.
So there were people that came. There were people that came before them, and there were religious people that came before them. But they were mostly out of the Church of England. This was really the first group that came that wanted to start a new faith, and a lot of it was based on some of the things that we still believe in today: a local congregation having the authority, elders and deacons. They believed in immersion for baptism. They believed in meeting with the church weekly. They met Sunday mornings and they met Sunday afternoons. Both services were 2 hours. Bradford, in one of his writings, said that they started at 9 and went to 11 in the morning and again in the afternoon from 3 to 5. And they also met on the weekdays. They met on Thursday afternoons as well. They met 3 times. They gave offerings and prayers, and their services were very plain and simple. They did not use instrumental music in their services. The men sat on one side, the women sat on the others, and the elders sat up front. So, neat history, neat writing. A lot of, like I said, what I was taken from came from writings from this man, who was contemporary at the time, as well as a man named Bacon, who wrote in the late 1880s a book called The Genesis of the New England Churches. So if you're interested in doing a little bit more study, that's where a lot of this information has come from. Thank you for your attention.